The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Upgrade your tool storage for the new year with help from Menards. For heavy-duty storage that protects your tools, choose MasterForce. From shelving units to cabinets and so much more, you can keep your tools safe and within reach. Get versatile and durable storage from MasterForce today. Check out all our MasterForce storage in-store or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hi there, welcome back once again to I Never Thought It Would Happen, brought to you by my good self, Chris Difford, and the wonderful charity Help Musicians. Joining me on this episode is a hugely talented cellist, singer, and composer from South Africa. He's been endorsed by Yo-Yo Ma, who's guested on the South African's debut album. He's played at the Royal Albert Hall and the BBC Proms. And I'm also delighted to say that, like me, he's an ambassador for Help Musicians. So I'm very much looking forward to our chat. Please welcome Abel Salawoche. Nice to see you.
Likewise. Nice to meet you.
So where are you, Abel?
I'm in Manchester at the moment.
Is that home?
Yes, it is. It is home. So I have my family here, my daughter.
Oh, lovely.
Who is one.
Okay.
And my partner, who's also a musician, and we live together, just the three of us.
Oh, wow. And you came from Soweto to Manchester?
No, actually, I come from a place called Sebokeng.
Oh, where's that?
So Sebokeng is the south of Johannesburg.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
It's close to a river called the Vaal River. And I'm kind of a big river in the south of Johannesburg. Yeah. And I studied music in Soweto.
Oh, you did, yeah.
But I did end up in Manchester.
Yes. All good people end up in Manchester,
you know,
apparently.
Yes.
So
yeah.
What could I say?
Yes.
So as a fellow ambassador to Help Musicians, it's wonderful to meet you. And what was it that sort of attracted you and brought you to Help Musicians?
I think the title says it all.
Yeah.
I think the title says it all. And, you know, coming from South Africa, it was always a real struggle to survive over here as a student.
Yeah.
And we're always looking for help and, you know, in any way possible that we can find. And I think Help Musicians was like the first port of call, really, you know, after receiving any funding from my music college.
Yeah.
And they gave me a wonderful scholarship, actually, for cellists called the Motosetsky.
Mm-hmm.
And it changed everything, because then I was able to do like competitions, which was a big thing at the time in my previous classical life. And
yeah.
Was like the step forward, you know, and opened many doors. Yeah.
And do you mentor people on Help Musicians? I know I've been asked to do that.
Actually, not yet. I would love to.
Yeah, you'd be very good at it.
You reckon?
I think so.
Yeah, I would love to do it, but it's firstly finding the space and time. Yeah, but I would love to, you know, pull somebody up like I was pulled up in a certain sense. So, yeah.
How were you pulled up? I mean, when you were a young boy, what was it attracted you to music? Was it in your family roots?
I think in the family, there was a need for the children in the family to have some kind of deep focus. And because, you know, a lot of the time it's like you have school, but at the same time, there was so much that happens in the township. It's not all bad influences, just to say that, actually, just to clarify that. But it's, you know, it's a tough place to live sometimes because of a lack of access to opportunities and many different types of belonging, you know, that you can find as a child.
Yeah.
And some of them were not so good. And we went to school with kids who had very, very different backgrounds. And I think, you know, even though we didn't have money, but I was still kind of lucky because I had a family that was kind of matted together by our traditions, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a father and mother in the household, which is like a crazily important thing, even though, you know, to a middle-class person, maybe in the UK that I live around, that sounds pretty normal, but it wasn't in the township. So,
yeah.
You know, my mom was always like, you better find something to do on the weekends or I'll find something for you.
Oh, no.
And that would have meant washing laundry and clothes you know, and doing the errands. But my brother was amazing. So he was the first kind of pull up, you know. He went out there and wanted to find something beautiful that we could both focus on. So, and he found music and he began playing the bassoon, funny enough. Yeah.
That sounds very odd, bassoon.
Yeah.
In the middle of where you were living, that's a strange instrument.
Definitely. It was alien, extremely alien. It looks alien.
It looks alien, yeah. It looked like the Pied Piper.
Exactly, with the buttons and, you know, what is this machine? What is this thing? And, and he was, you know, he was really good at it. And he had another friend. His friend's name was Lucky and my brother's name is Sammy. And Lucky and Sammy were my blueprint, you know. They're my blueprint for how to be... pretty much how to be a man or how to be a, you know, a black boy surviving in the township, but also looking for a way out in some senses, like a or further opportunity or more access to the world.
Yeah. Were you listening to Western radio or Western music or just local music at that time?
We listened to everything, you know, sponges. We just gobble everything up and have a mishmash all the time. I think the way I would describe our lives was very much a mishmash of any influence we could take. So, yeah, we listened to classical radio, Classic FM, actually.
Okay.
It was a big part of our lives for some reason. And we would record all the tracks, like, so Haydn Cello Concerto, we would record with the cassette, press play and record.
Mm-hmm.
Record that stuff and keep it for ourselves. But at the same time, we listened to a lot of house music. You know, we would record that too, like record playlists and a lot of like compilations we used to make of very different music. And it makes me even think about how strange we were with food, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like Western influences just touched African influences willy-nilly. Like things happened that were unexpected. Would be like having pasta with like tin fish. The next day would be like, you know, bap, which is like a maize meal type thing with like, because we got lucky, maybe we found a really nice fish. So it would be kind of like, you know, really the connections were just happening by themselves, because I think the township is influenced by the West because there's like, you know, trickles of that influence over time.
Yeah.
But we are still also living very much the lives that, you know, our forebears taught us to live.
Of course, yeah. And then, so getting your first instrument, where would you have gone to get your first instrument?
I didn't have one at the beginning, yeah. So, my brother took me to the school in Soweto.
Oh, so the schools had good musical instruments for you to use?
Well, it was an outreach program. So they had like a select few. So they would have like maybe four flutes, you know, two cellos, you know, three violins, one tuba, that kind of thing. And the kids would just play and do a rotation around the stuff. But at one point, you kind of choose that you want to stay with one instrument. And I guess the blanket instrument for like any child that was going to learn how to read music was recorder. So there was like a million recorders.
Oh, no.
So I know. Terrible times. No, but it was beautiful at the same time because it was just like, that's the first thing you jump on and you graduate to a real instrument, quote unquote. But, and the cello was one. And the cello was one not because I liked it at the beginning, but it's because I liked the person who was teaching it.
Yes, always the teacher.
Yeah. Teachers are pretty incredible.
I was thinking about that yesterday, that as a young lyricist and poet, when I was at school, I wasn't very good at anything, and all teachers would just hit me on the head. And then one day, a stand-in English teacher came in, and he said, "Have you heard of Bob Dylan?" And I said, "I hadn't." And he said, "Maybe you should try and write like that, you know." And it only takes one teacher to open the door, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you've never forgotten that, you know. I think that's pretty incredible that somebody would make that kind of impression. Even today, I don't know, inside, there's still a sense of looking up to them somehow, yeah. Even if they're not there.
Absolutely,
you know?
Yeah.
So that stays with you. And funny enough, I think because we listened to Classic FM already, the guy was a presenter on Classic FM. And he was a young black dude, you know, with dreadlocks like me now.
Yeah.
And his parents were the heads of this outreach program, and his name was Kutlwano Masote. And when he met me, he'd just come back from the Menuhin school in Switzerland. It was like a kind of high school for young talented musicians who were supremely gifted. And he'd just come back from there, and he'd had like kind of, I guess, a taste of another world. And again, he was already probably in the next bracket of privilege than I had ever been and I had ever seen.
Yeah.
And he came with like a wealth of information, and the way he parted with it was like magic. So I stuck to that, you know.
The cello is very beautiful. The sound is almost like an extension of your body, it seems. When I listen to you play and watch you play, it's as almost like it's another limb. Do you feel that? Do you feel really connected to it?
It's taken a while to get there.
Oh, is it?
But yeah. I think when you are a kid, you're like always imitating what you know on a tool. Or, you know, we use this as a tool. So we just basically go, you know, can this play like Zulu, like Mbakanga music? Okay, does that work? And it feels like a bit of an uphill learning steep feeling, you know. But we'd do it anyway, and then we'd know some of these songs, and, you know, we'd play them to our friends to impress them, or to play things that were cool, that we thought were cool. And we're just basically taking stuff and putting it on the instrument. And then we just basically learned that, you know, the process is that there's a beginning where you know nothing, to a place where you feel like you flow and you kind of understand and you get used to things.
Yeah.
And that seems to happen again and again and again. Mm-hmm. So to learn all these different songs, you have to go through the same process. So it was like, okay, is it an extension of my body? Yes, to a certain extent. And then I go back to being literally a child on it again.
Yeah, wow, that's lovely, yeah.
Yeah, you just got to get used to sounding terrible and then get used to getting better, because that gives you like quite a lot of hope, you know. And I think later on, after college, when you played for a long time, it became scary not to get better, you know. There were times where I was like, am I really getting better? I can't quite tell, you know. And maybe that was a measurement for then, actually, that has probably also now changed completely.
And how was your discipline around learning the instrument? Were you very good at pacing yourself and giving yourself enough time?
The beginning, it wasn't up to me. You know, my brother was a bulldog.
Was he?
You know, my brother.
Good for him.
Yeah. He was. He used to say this thing in Sotho, like "ikwale," which means like lock yourself in, man.
Yeah.
Have a lock in with yourself.
Wow, you know? That's a good one.
Yeah. And he'd just go like, you know, and we'd have friends on the window, like on the side of the bedroom that I used to practice on, and they'd be like, you know, knocking, and the window would be open. I'd hear them playing, and he'd be like, there's no way you're going out there, man. For the next 2 hours, from 5 till 7, this is you and the instrument. And, you know, of course, that was not so easy at the beginning, but I just got used to that feeling.
So it's like a romance, I guess, building up your relationship with an instrument, particularly something like a cello.
It is. It feels like the experience is much more malleable than just like you know, as I said before, you know, you don't completely just know something.
No.
That's not how it works. I think you keep being like some sort of learner. And of course, now you have this whole catalog of things, you know, mm-hmm. you know, which is really beautiful. And you can share it and you can enjoy the rewards of sharing it. But at the same time, yeah, my brother was kind of hell-bent on me spending time with myself and learning how to do that well.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the beautiful gifts of music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so cool. You can spend time on your own and not be lonely or alone.
That's really true, isn't it? It's kind of, you have to be on your own to learn the instrument or to be a writer. You obviously have time to compose your own music too, and that's a very special place.
Yeah, it is. It is. Do you spend a lot of time alone?
Even when I'm with people, I'm alone. Because, you know, if I'm writing, like I've been recently writing poetry for some reason, and I've really enjoyed the process of discovering another part of my instrument, if you like. So, yeah, I do like being alone. I think it's always been that way, because when I was brought up, my parents were at work and I was left at home to sort of mind my own business.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was also part of the thing for us. Like, our parents were never home, you know? Like,
yeah.
We are definitely different generations, but, you know, like, nowadays, I think parents don't really leave children on their own in the house.
Well, of course, the children now have mobile phones and iPads to have as friends, and, you know, they can Google the world. You know, whereas when I was growing up, you know, if you wanted to find out something, you had to get on a bus to go and find out. I had to get on a bus to go and get records for my record collection, you know, so it's very different then. When you're performing live, do you find like you go into a spiritual state where you leave yourself behind?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's the best part of the day.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's the best part. I spend all day waiting for this moment. You go, oh, shit, I can't wait till this arrives, because actually it's the one moment of the day to forget yourself,
yeah.
You know.
God, that's true.
Yeah, it's really freeing. I mean, but the interesting thing is, I can't get away from the idea that it really does come with preparation to be free, which is such an odd thought sometimes for the technical side of things. But then, you know, the point is to get on stage and kind of forget about it. It's like you've kind of prepared the routes, you know, the pathways. But once you start going down them, then you have to begin to really improvise and be yourself even more. So I think I'm forever, you know, forever waiting for that moment to like go free. I find practice very difficult, actually, at the moment.
Me too. I can't stand it. I mean, it's, you know, I remember as a young boy being in a rehearsal room with the band and just thinking, I can't wait to get out of here. You know, being on stage making mistakes is kind of part of your relationship with the audience, I think. You know, that one-to-one, you know, conversation you have with the audience is so important, and it gives you the freedom to find a higher spiritual place. It's,
yeah.
Some people call it the peak experience.
The peak experience. That's cool. I mean, it's vulnerability, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so universal and so relatable to the people you're playing for.
Yeah.
And to pretend otherwise is very difficult. And I think sometimes playing, you know, being a classical musician, and of course I'm now playing my own style of music, but playing, you know, sonatas and concertos and being in that world, if you are not careful, you can pretend that perfection and accuracy is the paramount thing and the thing that you need to get, and that's the point of your evening when you go and play.
Yeah.
And it's precisely the opposite, you know, and some of the most touching, even classical concerts I've been to, forego that whole play accurately thing. So
you collaborated with Yo-Yo Ma, I think, on your debut album. What did you learn from him? What was he like?
Legend.
Legend.
I mean, yeah, absolute legend. I think he's such a great collaborator, you know, and his curiosity like makes him find out loads of things about you, which is amazing because you kind of go, oh, you understand my style because you went and looked it up. Like, even though you're this, you know, amazing musician who probably doesn't have a lot of time to spare. But like when he came and we did the recording on, you know, like this conversation on Zoom, you know, that's crazy. Like, and he was on the other side of the world in Boston and he had my recording. And he sat back and I just said, you play, you know, again and again, and let's go for that. And we did it three times. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, I've got to go. And that was wonderful. And that was it. but from then on, we've spoken so much. And I think most of all about him is his spirit of humanity, I think, actually. Just being able to get under the skin of society and of a people is kind of, he does that so naturally.
Yeah.
And the music is just a part of that, really.
I'm Chris Difford, and you're listening to I Never Thought It Would Happen. Coming up next, I'm answering your questions.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hi, I'm Maxime Elliott. I'm a pop soul music artist, and last year I was fortunate to receive funding from Help Musicians to develop new skills in music production, guitar, and vocals. It was my first experience with a grant, and it truly changed my life. Not only did it provide me with the motivation to keep pursuing music, but it also gave me the resources I needed to push forward at that time. And I also got to take part in Help Musicians mentoring program, which has been a game changer because it helped me meet new people and receive ongoing support. And my question for Chris is there a particular song you've written that still resonates with you in a unique way or one you feel especially proud of? And has that changed over time?
Hey, Maxime, thank you so much for your message, your audio message. And I'm so pleased that Help Musicians is doing a fantastic job for you, as they do for so many people. Is there a song that I think is outstanding in my repertoire, and has it changed over the years? Well, many, I think. But if I had to pick one, I suppose it would be Up the Junction, because I don't know where it came from, and it's just grown over the years, and the more I hear it, and the more I appreciate it. So I hope that answers your question. Thank you, Maxime. See you again soon. This is an email from Sebio, Mr. Sebio indeed. When you find yourself stuck with where you are in music and you don't know what the next step is, what do you do both directly and indirectly that would lead you where you needed to be? Well, I have no answer to that. I really don't. I kind of just find myself floating around, and I sometimes end up in the right place, but I don't let it bother me, and I don't overthink what situation I'm in at any given time. I just let it flow over me like I'm a rock in a river. I hope that helps. This is from Zero to Hero. Hi, Chris. Just wondering what advice you have for two identical twin brothers who are 15 years old and are looking for a career as musicians. We want to study music at college after our GCSEs, but wonder if you have any advice. My advice is to follow your ambition. I don't know whether twin brothers is a problem, but I think it's probably not. I think it's probably a good thing. So I wish you both well and have a fantastic journey, and keep me informed of how it's going. This is from Michael William from North London. Hi, Chris. On quite a few of your podcasts, you've mentioned that when you're trying to write, you find yourself staring out the window, waiting for the inspiration to strike. But what's going on here? Is it like a meditative state where the mind goes quiet, allowing the subconscious access? Are you waiting to see something that will literally be a catalyst for a song, say about two lovers, or a majestic sunset? Or is it something else? What's going on, Chris? Or is it a trade secret? Yours faithfully. Well, Michael, it's not a trade secret. I just love looking out the window and staring into space because I don't believe you can chase songs. Just recently I've been writing poetry and I found myself looking out the window quite a lot because I'm not really sure whether I'm getting it right or wrong. But it doesn't really matter, I don't think. As long as the words read interestingly on a page, then I think I've hit the nail on the head. But you will be the judge of that when my lyric book comes out later this year. So, thank you for your message. With your new record, Hymns of Bantu, where did you record that and how long did it take to process that album?
I recorded that in Manchester. Yeah, at a place called Stoller Hall.
Uh-huh.
And Stoller Hall is like it's at the Cheetham School of Music. And basically I called all my friends who live in Manchester to create a string section. And then I called my percussionists who, one of them lives in Berlin now, but he's from Senegal. And another one lives in Manchester and he's from Ivory Coast. So, you know, very West African drummers, skin drums, djembe, talking drum and all that kind of stuff. And then my bass player from Ireland was there too, and a pianist from the UK, but also Argentinian, who's just like a wild, wild musician because he's crazy about Baroque music. And he's also crazy about improvised music. And I was like, okay, you know, then I simply just said, can you produce the album, actually? Because I think you know me best and how to traverse both worlds in a very, you know, coherent way. And I think that's what we wanted from Hymns of Bantu, to feel African, but also have this like classical aspect, like rather than we're doing a fusion, it wasn't that, it was just like, you know, a piece of DNA that includes both, you know, both parts of my being.
Yeah. Wow. You composed everything yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote most things, but some things were traditional hymns, you know, from South Africa that people would know like the back of their hand, but then also decided to make arrangements that felt like me, but would still resonate with people at home. Because most of all, I wanted people to put on the album and just sing with it, you know? And I think South Africans are just so good at that and love doing that. So yeah, that's Hymns of Bantu.
Yeah, that's a really amazing thing. Hymns are very popular again, it seems to me.
Right, yeah.
Whenever you go, or whenever I go on Radio 3, there's always some kind of choral music, Voices 8, Eric Whittaker.
Yes, yeah.
And it seems people need that now more than ever. They need a space to take themselves musically, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, I never force my audience, but I do think the listening experience at a live concert has to be a very active listening experience, like very non-passive.
Yeah.
Because I feel like different audiences, you know, different audiences in the West maybe will come to a concert and will want to sit and consume information.
Yeah.
But sometimes I find that in South Africa that there's like sparks of reaction that end up being out of the control of the performer.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, such a beautiful thing, because that means really you're playing for, you know, a community that's actually listening in the moment. And the concert experience sometimes for what I'm doing right now can very much include the audience to just jump on and I'll make them sing without me. You know, I'll sit at the end of the stage and just have them do their thing because something about that is so rewarding, because they've come here sometimes alone, but to experience something with other people, and they leave almost like having new friends. And I think that's important. It's not like, you know, going to the cinema and then, you know, you have that experience with your eyes and your ears and then, you know, very like from you to the screen and then you leave. You know? But the concert shouldn't be quite like that.
Do you feel that when you go and see other people perform?
That's a great question.
Do you engage in that way?
Yes, I do. I do. Yeah. I try to, you know, I go to a lot of varied things, but like I go to a lot of jazz music gigs, but also I go to, you know, I went to a club a few days ago. I got permission from my family. Like, guys, just give me this one chance. Okay. I'll be right back. And we went to this beautiful place called Soup Kitchen and people were dancing. And I think there can be like I have a very African way of doing it where the people that I go out with, I really want to pull them into my world. And and we dance together and we make up stuff together and kind of, you know, be joyous and ululate in that sense rather than move from left to right. You know?
Yeah.
And I think basically I tend to want to react to what I go and experience in an outward way. But sometimes it's not always like that, you know. But if the mood takes, then of course, yes.
Do you think the music industry is more open now for someone like yourself?
I hope so.
Yeah.
I
mean, you have the internet at your door, so you're always going to be heard around the world, which is a lovely thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, as you said, there's just a need for this communal scream together. Like everybody just needs some sort of being a part of something very beautiful and with other people they might not know, and but still having a sense of familiarity that we are people living in the same community. Because often I think our lives, especially people who work in the modern times, like young people in their 30s and 40s, both partners or people in the family are always working. It's very intense, you know, and people are losing out on time to be part of communities, whereas the structure of old families is very different. You know, some people didn't work, some people did.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was always somebody at home and, you know, things like that were so, so beautiful in certain respects.
So where you lived growing up, have you been back there recently and is the music thriving there?
Oh, I took my daughter back.
You did?
She's one now, but she was maybe 6 months at the time.
Okay.
When we went. I mean, to be honest about the township that I come from, Sebokeng, it's a very, very quiet place. It's almost rural. It's very different from a place like Soweto where there's like a huge hustle and bustle of different things happening.
Mm.
But nonetheless, there is some art, you know, some beautiful things, some poetry, some guys putting on beautiful nights and making music in different places and traditional ceremonies everywhere. So that's still occurring very much. But in the day, it's a very like docile place.
Really?
You know?
Yeah.
Time really expands. You know, when I went, the electricity went off for 2 weeks.
What?
Yeah. I arrived and there was no electricity for 2 weeks. And I was like, this is classic, you know, with my Manchester and you know, workaholic ways. I was like, I need to do these emails. And and actually, my mom was like, oh, sorry for you. There's nothing here to do that. So we sat for 2 weeks at home without any internet.
That must have been great.
It was very revealing and very beautiful. Yeah.
Did you have a cello there?
No
instrument.
No instruments. We had our voices. We sang lots.
Wow.
My dad has a huge collection of CDs.
Does he?
And yeah, he does. Yeah. He used to have records, but then he sold his record player. And then he plays music in the car, you know, because that's the only source of electricity we'll have for the time. And we would sit in the garage where the car is, you know.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. He would open the both sides of the garage doors and just, you know, blast some tunes and have a beer and we just talk the night away. I mean, it's crazy. You wake up and you think, oh, this is going to be a long day. But before you know it, you know, the cicadas are going outside.
So. And Western music, is there anything that appeals? And, you know, are there any records that you would take to a desert island with you?
Wow. And by Western, do you mean classical or do you mean any?
Not classical, because that's kind of would be an obvious thing. But mm-hmm. I would imagine Joni Mitchell, maybe.
Hmm. You ever think? The Western music. Oof, need to look through my catalogue. You know, I think that there's, you know, the American side of things, there were people who were making very, very beautiful things. People like Harry Belafonte.
Wow.
Yeah. I very much love that kind of music.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And again, I'm now speaking about the black experience, but from the Western side.
Yeah, in that sense. I get that. Yeah.
I'm very, very much attracted to that world. And they were also very attracted to, you know, to this side of things. But then when we come to the UK, I mean, there's a raw energy in some people, like John Cooper Clarke, somebody like this, you know, with the kind of poems. And like, I never thought I'd experience that kind of visceral way of speaking other than in my language, mm-hmm. you know. I always thought, this stuff is going to be pretty light and, you know, pretty not as expressive as I would hope for. But I feel like I've found a rawness in people like that over here.
Yeah.
I love a bit of Sting, you know.
Okay. He'd love you. I know he would. I've toured with John Cooper Clarke, and one of the things that amazed me about him is how he remembered everything. I mean, because he just seems like he's on another planet. When you meet him, you think, where is he? He's gone, you know. And then he goes on stage and he recites for an hour everything perfectly in time.
That's mad.
So his voice and his poetry is his cello, I guess.
Yeah. And it's, you know, again, we're saying at the beginning, it's the personality of the person that, you know, the way they carry themselves and also what they find funny just cracks me up. And, you know, I never thought Western humor would crack me up. Because, you know, I always had a very different way of thinking about that. But he's, you know, one for the ages and one to be remembered. And I see so much of him in a lot of African culture in a lot of ways.
Wow.
You know, That's
interesting.
Yeah, the ability to, you know, to be like a real gem of the community because he's really well known, but he's never really changed. And I think that's difficult for a lot of people not to do.
I can tell you're in Manchester with the sirens going by.
Yeah, there's a lot going on outside. Yeah.
So what does the year hold for you, Abel?
What's coming up? So I'm about to actually have my launch for Hymns of Bantu mm-hmm. in London at a place called Troxy in East London.
I know Troxy, yeah.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah,
you'll enjoy that.
Yeah, it's a fun old place. So we're going to play there and have a huge celebration there of this body of work. And then, yeah, I'd love to see everybody who's around. That'd be great. And then we moved to Australia for a month with the family. And I'll be working over there with the Australian Chamber Orchestra, making music, writing my own stuff, working with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then coming back to the UK, I'll be, you know, playing lots of places, Wigmore Hall, and a certain big festival that I'm probably not allowed to say at this point just yet, but
I can imagine.
It's in the summer and it's down south and it's very fun. And
I know.
Yes,
yeah.
So it's going to be fantastic and it's going to be beautiful. So those are the things that are coming up, but I'm also just trying to focus on writing some new music.
Yeah. When you come down south and you play that festival that you're not going to say where it is, but I know where it is, it's in the village where I live.
Oh, no way.
So I'm going to come and see you.
You better do.
Yeah, I'm going to come and see you. It's just across the field.
How nice is that?
Yeah. So you got a busy year then, and you take your family with you everywhere.
Yeah, we try to do that, you know, because otherwise then I'm gone for too long without them. And we also try to coordinate our musical lives. So, you know, my partner will come to Australia and she will play with me in Australia as well.
What does she play?
She's a viola player.
Fantastic.
She's a viola player. Yeah. She's an Irish viola player and she's been making magic for the longest time.
Mm-hmm.
And I met her through music as well. And she'll be playing with me for the most part. And we just take our daughter with us and have somebody take care while we're on stage. Otherwise, we're with her. Yeah.
And well-being on the road, how do you look after yourself?
It's hard.
It is.
Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard. Balance, asking for help from people, you know.
Ah, mm-hmm.
I think we surround ourselves with people that want to be part of like the family in that sense, so we can pass Alva on and we can lose track of where she is in the nicest way possible. And if we can find environments like that for ourselves, that really helps us. Sleep. Oh, sleep. I didn't value sleep before because, you know, after every concert would be some sort of celebration. And there's always a temptation to do that. But sleep is pretty golden at the moment. Yeah.
It's integral.
Yeah. Yeah. To just having, you know, no matter how much stress you have in your life, if you have enough sleep, you can handle it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it goes so quickly. When I wake up, I think, oh, no. But when I was a teenager, I didn't get up. I was just asleep all the time. Abel, it's been a complete joy talking to you. Thank you so much. And I'm so pleased to meet another ambassador from Help Musicians.
Likewise.
Because that's what this podcast is for.
Thank you so much.
And I really will make it my mission this summer to come and say hello and shake your hand.
Yes, absolutely. I can't wait to see you there. Yeah, many beautiful souls converge there. So that'll be a beautiful thing.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chris. And also thank you to Help Musicians. You guys have always been amazing. So I'm very, very thankful for the continued love for everybody, which is so, so helpful.
Oh, I agree.
Awesome.
God bless.
You too, Chris. You too, Chris.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye. Bye.
Ciao.
That was an amazing conversation, and there's so much to take away from that. I've been mulling over a lot of what Abel had to say. In particular, I like the fact that he doesn't mind making mistakes when he's playing. Sometimes there can be a highlight of a performance, and I like to call it an out-of-body experience, maybe. Music kind of takes you into a very special place, and even when you do make mistakes, it's absolutely brilliant. After all, we are humans and not machines. And when humans come together as a community to celebrate music, that's where the magic happens. So thank you so much, Abel. I really enjoyed that conversation. If you want to know more about the amazing work that Help Musicians does, then take a look at their website, follow them on social media like I do, and please consider donating a little money to the charity. They do incredible work supporting musicians of all types across the UK, changing people's lives for the better. And don't forget, I'm taking your questions about anything music-wise, from writing, recording, touring, and everything in between. Your well-being, maybe. Send your questions to chris@helpmusicians.org.uk. That's chris@helpmusicians.org.uk. And please subscribe to the podcast. It makes all the difference. Keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Give Me Sugar production for Help Musicians.